There is a sense of terror, there is a sense of fear that is real for millions of Americans.
All thinking people oppose terrorism, both domestic and international. But one should not be used to cover the other.
No, I'm not being paranoid, but somebody is after us.
Somebody blew up America!
Congress has revealed again, you know, that the great majority of them don't represent anything but their pocketbooks.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush has signed into law the war-making resolution passed by Congress and told wary world leaders to, quote, face up to our global responsibilities to confront Saddam Hussein. Bush said those who choose to live in denial may eventually be forced to live in fear. Every nation that shares in the benefits of peace, he says, also shares in the duty of defending the peace. Inherent in the administration's policy towards Iraq is the stated desire to not only disarm Saddam Hussein, but to oust him from the office of president. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said during a recent press briefing something to the effect that a single bullet to the head would be cheaper than a war. It's officially known as regime change. The concept is being embraced by some Saddam opponents on both the left and the right, but the consensus ends over how Saddam should be removed. In our next segment, we have a roundtable discussion with three analysts of nonviolence practices. Anas Shalal is an Iraqi-American and a peace fellow with the Seeds of Peace program and co-founder of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and the Peace Cafe, a venue for Arabs and Jews to speak to one another. Our second guest is Barry Gahn, a professor of philosophy and the philosophy of nonviolence at St. Bonaventure University in upstate New York, and he's the editor of the Acorn Journal of the Gandhi King Society. And finally, we're joined by Jack Duvall, who is director of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict and author of A Force More Powerful. His organization trains Iraqi oppositionists in nonviolent resistance. Gentlemen, I'd like to begin our discussion with the legalities of the concept of regime change. Is it legal for our president to determine that Saddam Hussein is not fit to rule Iraq and therefore should be removed from office?
Well, there's no legal prohibition against giving assistance to groups and organizations that are for the purpose of accomplishing democratic change and building civil society.
Jack Duvall.
That's correct. But on the other hand, there is obviously a law in the international community and in international law, a longstanding prohibition against using military force to change the government of another country. So it's a question of how you define regime change.
And go ahead, Barry,
I would simply add to that that if we're talking about regime change as the initiation of hostilities, I believe that it's an explicit violation of the UN Charter, probably a violation of findings in Nuremberg, and certainly a violation of customary international law.
And Anas Shalal, as the Iraqi-American in this discussion, what is your reaction when you hear the term regime change?
I was rather surprised to hear Ali Fleischer's comments about the idea of one bullet will take care of him. This kind of talk seems like it's talk of a rogue type of nation rather than a civilized country that's supposed to go about adhering to international laws and international norms. So it was rather surprising to see this kind of thing. It's like all the gloves are off, and it just didn't bode very well.
It's also not a very smart strategy because if one bullet were all that it took, Saddam Hussein would have been brought down by now, because there have been several violent attempts to displace him or depose him, and they've all failed. And one of the reasons is that dictators are very good at the game of violence. Mm-hmm. What they don't expect is nonviolent civilian resistance.
Absolutely. And I think if you're going to, like you mentioned, if you're going to take somebody down with a bullet, chances are the person that pulled the trigger is going to be the next leader, and he's going to be as bad or if not worse than Saddam Hussein. And that's not what the Iraqi people need or want. They deserve better.
You know, when Gennaro Arriagada, one of the leaders of the broad coalition that was successful in displacing Augusto Pinochet in Chile, spoke at a conference that I attended in January. He said that after the change took place and the People's Movement won the plebiscite, and then and their victory managed to split the military junta, who declined to follow Pinochet's orders to crack down, which is why he had to exit the presidency. He said when that plebiscite was won the following day, he said, who in Chile was able to say that they were responsible for the change?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a violent vanguard. It wasn't a group of coup leaders. It wasn't even a revolutionary movement. He said, how many Chileans could say that? 8 million Chileans could say that. In other words, they took their own country back.
Yes, Jack Duvall. Now, there was actually an election today that reelected Saddam Hussein by 100%, wink, wink. And so, you know, whose decision is it to decide that Saddam Hussein is not the actual president, the elected president of Iraq, particularly what seems to bother me or disturb me, and I think other Americans as well, is that here we have a president in this country who was basically selected by a panel on the U.S. Supreme Court telling another country that they need to change their leader.
Yeah, I think you know, I don't think anyone was surprised about the unanimous support for Saddam Hussein, you know, the way that it happened. But I think what's important to understand is whenever a nation is under siege like the Iraqis feel that they are, I think people are going to rally behind whoever happens to be their leader, no matter how bad he is. I may not be supportive of Bush, but if I knew that the United States was under attack, I'd probably rally behind him as well.
Well, let me take just general exception to that, if I might, because we do know that there are serious consequences if you vote no in a Saddam referendum. People have been imprisoned. People have even been shot if they have. It's been determinable that they actually voted no in a referendum on Saddam. There have been two or three referendums up to this point. No one, I think, really wants to suggest that this particular dictator has obtained the consent of his own people in anything approaching a fair election. And what we saw yesterday in Iraq was really quite phony.
Right.
The question is, you need a government that, in fact, can manifestly say that it has received the consent of the people. And the it seems to me we're on treacherous ground if we get into comparisons of legitimacy between different governments. The key question is this. Does political change or the reaffirmation of a government in power, does it come from the consent of the people? That's why democracy is usually thought of as the most reliable system, at least the most reliable political system we know today, to be able to deliver a legitimate government. In fact, today inside Iraq, there is enormous opposition to and acts of opposition to Saddam Hussein. This is the largest unreported political phenomenon in this whole crisis. There is, in fact, today inside Iraq, potential civilian resistance, which, if activated and led strategically, in our judgment, could displace this particular dictator in a matter of a few months. That's the potential tragedy vis-a-vis military action.
Yes.
I think the kind of dissent that you're talking about is probably it's coming out mostly from the Shiites and the Kurds.
And
no, it's happening in central Iraq, too, among Iraqis. I have a list here.
You mean among the Baghdadis?
Absolutely. I have a list here of all the various acts of opposition that has been sent to me by an Iraqi exile group, which is in continuous communication with people doing these things inside Iraq. We're talking about liberation of political prisoners through bribes, well known in Iraq today that any prisoner can be freed for a high enough bribe.
Yes.
People resigning from their jobs, creation of underground networks to hide people on the run from the government, mass cancellation of Ba'ath Party memberships, mass desertions from the army, small acts of resistance like ostentatiously watching American and British planes flying over cities like Basra, citizen penetration of government agencies to obtain documents by bribes. So I would
venture to guess, though, that
let's give Anas Shalala a chance
to respond. If Iraq comes under attack, that you're not going to have a whole lot of people just turning onto Saddam. I think the way that he structured his his own power, is that they're going to have to go through a few circles before they get to him.
And that's exactly
and
the problem
with the circles
with
are the ones that are going to have to turn around and obviously get him.
Right, but with it, but in a civilian resistance, what you present those agents of repression with is a mass civilian movement that is determined to bring the ruler down. And then the outermost, least reliable members of the security apparatus have to consider their own options.
Yeah. When he's even ensured that you know, that much of that would not happen. He's already sort of hired a whole bunch of thugs that are going to go around in Baghdad making sure that people stay into their homes.
So what is the answer?
But no. But no, let me tell you, the mechanics of that don't work when the willingness to engage in acts of resistance begins to broaden. Let me give you a little anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
We were meeting with a Iraqi democracy activist in northern Iraq who's quite familiar with conditions in Baghdad, mm-hmm. there being so many Kurds as well who live in Baghdad, a couple of months ago. And he was saying, well, no, we love your ideas about civilian resistance to oppose Saddam, but frankly said, I'm dubious because, look, Saddam is not Milosevic or Pinochet. He's Stalin, you know, and the repression will prevent it. So we engaged in the following little thought exercise with him. We said, you know, what would happen if 5,000 people demonstrated in downtown Baghdad against Saddam? And he said, well, that's easy. They'd all be shot. Well, what if 10,000 people demonstrated? He said, oh, that would be even bloodier, but they'd all be shot. Well, what if 25,000 people demonstrated? And he said, well, if that happened, it would be, you know, just tremendous disruption and difficult, and maybe it would take a couple of days, but basically Saddam would make sure that he maintained control.
Mm-hmm.
Then we said, well, what if 100,000 people demonstrated in downtown Baghdad against Saddam Hussein? What would happen then? And he paused, and then he said, well, if that actually happened, Saddam would be finished. And he said that mm-hmm. because that would be an advertisement to everyone in the repressive apparatus that Saddam was on his way out because the civilian population opposed him, and they would then not act on orders to engage in repression against such a broad front of civilian opposition. This is how all these other dictators have come down, Marcos in the Philippines, Pinochet in Chile. It was even a factor in South Africa and in the East European regimes in 1989. This isn't something that Iraqi somehow can't manage on their own. That's
mm-hmm.
the dynamic of how this works.
Before you respond to that, I just want to sort of see if I can just kind of reintroduce our guest here. That was Jack Duvall, who is the author of With Weapons of the Will. Also joining us are Barry Gann, who is a professor of philosophy and nonviolence, and Anas Shalal, who is an Iraqi-American with the Seeds of Peace. Gentlemen, do we have any sort of consensus of opinion at this point? Do we have a consensus that removing Saddam Hussein nonviolently would be agreeable to all?
I think there's, you know, we have to keep in mind that the Iraqi people have been under the sanctions for 12 years. And they've been very brutal sanctions to the point where people have to sell their own personal belongings in order to make ends meet and eat, feed their families. So I think most of that has been used very well by Saddam to turn people against the United States and the West and making them the main reason for their suffering. I think it'd be more difficult today, in other words, to do what you're suggesting, which is the civil disobedience and overthrowing Saddam Hussein that way, than it would have been maybe 12 or 15 years ago. Because I think people don't have the focus at this point, because the United States is already putting them under this sort of pressure that they're coming from outside to do this regime change and overtake, and there's talk of you know, Tommy Franks being the, you know, the leader of Iraq for a while until things go.
And
people just don't have much taste for that kind of thing.
And on top of that, you're looking at a number of Iraqis, most of them, who have to worry about day-to-day existence.
Very
absolutely.
Gay.
Well, look, there are people who worry about day-to-day. There are people who worry about day-to-day.
Can work in the long term. I think that there's no telling whether it can work in the short term or will work in the short. I should say whether it will work in the short term or not.
You know,
but I think the danger of adopting military action is very evident if you look at the case of Afghanistan, where the United States adopted a technique of regime change violently in the late 70s and early 80s, and 20 years later, this has come back to haunt us in an atrocious manner. So that you can't just look at whether or not nonviolence works. You have to look at whether or not violence works also. And the truth is that violence only works at best half the time, because one side loses, and sometimes both sides lose. And so in the long term, certainly nonviolence is going to be better. And in the short term, it may be as well, but that's a difficult call.
No, I want to tell you, there are too many instances of very brutal dictators being brought down in very short periods of time.
Jack DeVos.
And the reason that that is true is that the cumulative effect over many years of the kind of oppression that Saddam has visited on, upon his own people gradually hardens it reduces to a very small core the people who are willing to fight for him in a true crisis. And at the present moment, there is in Iraq today the atmosphere of crisis. So our argument would be that at this time, a determined civilian resistance would in fact get more traction, and that would have a greater effect in a shorter period of time than would have been true 10 or 12 years ago, precisely because the latent hatred of this guy is so strong. And that should sharpen for all of us the sense of tragedy if there is military action. The problem today is that those who want to take military action don't understand how civilian resistance works.
And Shalal, you'll get the last word.
I think much of that hatred, unfortunately, has been turned toward the United States. And I would have loved to see that whole energy and hatred to be turned towards Saddam in order to depose him in any means or ways possible by the Iraqi people. But right now, I think the Iraqi people want to have the freedom to be able to move about, to be able to travel freely, to be able to communicate freely, to be able to just live, in order for them to start thinking about the idea of a regime change that's going to be long-lasting and is not going to be just serving the interests of the United States.
Thank you, gentlemen. Anas Shalal is an Iraqi-American and a Peace Fellow with the Seeds of Peace program and co-founder of the Mesopotamia Cultural Society and the Peace Cafe. Barry Gann is Professor of Philosophy in the Philosophy of Nonviolence at St. Bonaventure University in upstate New York. And Jack DeVos is Director of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict and the author of A Force More Powerful. The UN Security Council held open debate today on a new resolution on Iraq during a special session convened by South Africa on behalf of the non-aligned movement. Throughout the morning and early afternoon, one delegation after another urged restraint and sufficient time for UN weapons inspectors to confirm or deny the alleged presence of weapons of mass destruction before authorizing military force, as insisted by the United States and Britain. Robert Knight of WBAI has more from New York.
Iraqi Representative Mohammed al-Duri accused the United States of unabashedly seeking its oil reserves and using the UN as a fig leaf for global hegemony. He said no nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons of mass destruction were in Iraq, adding that the International Atomic Energy Agency had declared it no longer had pending matters in Iraq, and that the United Nations Special Commission, UNSCOM, had declared that Iraq had implemented 95% of its obligations in 1993. Neighboring Kuwait supported multinational action on Iraq and demanded information on Gulf War detainees, but said military force should only be used as a last resort. Delegates from Egypt, Yemen, Algeria, and the United Arab Emirates also called for Israel and the Mideast to be included in the current efforts to limit weapons of mass destruction. Today's debate coincided with President Bush's signing into law the congressional resolution authorizing force against Iraq if he declares that diplomatic means have failed to guarantee disarmament, a development alluded to in a bilingual comment by Tunisia's delegate to the Security Council.
First of all, we must put an end to warmongering hysteria. President Bush, in a fashion, gave a sign of hope by stating that war is not inevitable. Other speakers made the same point in the U.S. Senate, such as Senator Edward Kennedy and Senator John Warner, who stated that the Congress's resolution was not a blank check, but a deterrent. Then we need to rebuild multilateralism and place trust in the good common sense of the international community. In a very striking book, Joe Nye Doyon of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University wrote, and I quote in English,
"Teddy Roosevelt advised that we should speak softly but carry a big stick. Now that we have the stick, we need to pay more attention to the first part of his admonition, and we need not just to speak more softly but to listen more carefully."
End of quotation.
Although Iraq has agreed to the return of inspectors, team leader Hans Blix has delayed his departure pending any new resolutions. But South African delegate Dumisani Khumalo said that it would be illegal to authorize force while Iraq is in compliance, and he said the inspector should therefore depart immediately. Khumalo, representing the 130-member non-aligned movement, spoke with reporters during a break in the debate.
The message we're sending is that the government of Iraq has said inspectors could come. We should go ahead and allow the inspectors to go. And, you know, we don't see why we should start discussing attacking Iraq before we even allow the inspectors to go in and do their work, and then they'll come back and report to the council. Then the council can think about what next to do.
Do you think that Hans Blix needs another resolution before he sends the inspectors in?
Well, he says he doesn't need one, but he says that he doesn't actually need one to go in, but he doesn't want to be there when there's another resolution passed. So he would rather have the Security Council decide on a resolution. We are just saying, you know, allow the inspectors to go as soon as possible. That's much more important to us.
By saying that, I guess you would also be indicating that the previous resolutions were enough to allow the inspectors to return.
Well, we believe what Dr. Blix says, that he doesn't need any other resolution to go. So, you know, if that's the case, let's allow them to go as soon as possible.
Passage of a new Security Council resolution is currently stalled, with France and Russia continuing to oppose a U.S. draft which would authorize retaliation without review in the event of disagreements during the inspection process. Meanwhile, the Security Council debate continues. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
At a conference last weekend in Boston organized by the American Friends Service Committee, Manning Marable, professor and director of the African American Studies Program at Columbia University, gave a keynote address titled "The War on Terrorism and U.S. Hegemony, What Have We Learned?" In his address, Marable discusses the links between racism, attacks on civil liberties, and the U.S.'s drive towards war on Iraq.
The war on terrorism is being used as an excuse to eliminate civil liberties and democratic rights here at home. This war at home has had a profoundly racial dimension because the U.S. democracy was constructed on a racial foundation. Before there was a Declaration of Independence, there was structural racism in this country. Before there was a Constitution of the United States, there was institutional racism in this country. And so therefore, the state finds it difficult to advance a democratic, racially egalitarian argument during a time of crisis as it pursues war. When the state pursues war, it frequently throws up, because beneath the state there is this structural racism, the arguments of race. It relies on and manipulates latent racism and xenophobia at all levels of the society as the state produces and manufactures the need for war. And we have always seen this throughout U.S. history. Usually racism is used to target external enemies like the Japs during World War II or the Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. But in general, whenever the U.S. mobilizes militarily, whenever it goes to war, white racism goes with it hand in hand. Perhaps the most dangerous element of the Bush administration's campaign on the war against democratic and civil liberties in this country has been the deliberate manipulation of mass public hysteria. Millions of Americans who witnessed the destruction of the WTC are still to this day in a post-traumatic state. The American public was bombarded daily with a series of media-orchestrated threats focusing on everything from potential crop-dusting airplanes being used for bioterrorism to anthrax-contaminated packages delivered through the U.S. Postal Service to today random executions by an unknown assailant of people dropping their kids off at school and pumping gas at a filling station outside of Washington, D.C. There is a sense of terror, there is a sense of fear that is real for millions of Americans. In whose interest does this serve? Now, I'm not being paranoid, but somebody is after us. Why do we have all of these kinds of assaults on our sense of security? It gives us a sense that we must surrender our constitutional rights, that we should surrender our civil rights to an all-powerful authority that knows best how to protect us. That's the message that millions of Americans are receiving today. There is no accident that the Iraqi invasion and the Iraqi threat, the racialized terrorist other, was constructed on the eve of the 2002 national elections. What is the correlation between the fact that our economy has been in meltdown, that one-fourth of the equity on the U.S. stock exchange has disappeared in the last year, with the need to divert Americans' attention from the crisis in our country to focus on the external threat? This is not an accident. This is deliberate policy, and we must speak truth to power about it. One of the great capacities of the Black Freedom Movement has been our capacity to link politics with morality. In the letter from the Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King Jr. sharply confronted the hypocrisy and the contradictions of white liberals who profess their dedication to the principles of universal brother and sisterhood, yet who were unwilling to personally commit themselves to the politics of racial justice, to the struggle against Jim Crow racism. It is essential for people of conscience who truly believe in a just and democratic society to take a public stand, to challenge the evils they see around themselves every day. As Martin wrote, "I submit that a person who breaks the law that conscience tells him is unjust and willingly accepts the penalty by staying in jail to arouse the conscience over the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the very highest respect for the law." And so it is time, sisters and brothers, to follow out the creed of Dr. King. It is time for democratic resistance. How do we achieve a peaceful, humane, and socially just world? By having the courage to celebrate our passionate discontent with the way things are. Contented, satisfied people rarely want things to change too much. If you want to find out what new directions history is taking our society, we dare not wallow in the mainstream. We must stand at the edge. We must stand at the boundaries. We must listen to the poets of our society. We must learn from those who have little or nothing to lose. We must understand those who are homeless and hungry and unemployed. We must understand the pain and the tragedy that exists in this country when 46 million Americans, as we sit here this morning, lack health insurance. We have to understand the pain and the tragedy of racialization, of mass incarceration, of racial profiling upon millions and millions of people of color. We cannot fight for peace globally unless we fight for racial justice and peace at home too. Global apartheid is linked with the greatest crime in American history, the centrality of American racism. To fight against one or the other means we must fight against both. Martin Luther King Jr. believed that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. It only bends toward justice if we commit ourselves to the fight to peace to make it so. There can never be peace without justice, because without justice, there can be no peace. Thank you.
Columbia University Professor Manning Marable speaking in Boston, Massachusetts last weekend. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, New Jersey poet laureate Amira Baraka with a poem for President Bush.